Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. It shouldn't come as a surprise to listeners of this show that nature in general and wildlife in particular across the globe are in peril thanks to an expanding human population and an extractive economic system that has led to habitat loss, accelerating rates of a species extinction, and of course, planetary climate crisis. On this show, we're going to talk to two extraordinary women, both from the University of California at Davis's prestigious School of Veterinary Medicine, working to counter those effects. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Marcella Uhart on her work against a seemingly insurmountable problem, wildlife trafficking around the world, and the threat of that trade of unleashing future pandemics as exotic wildlife are being put into contact with people and places that they shouldn't be. Our first guest is addressing an issue much closer to home for me, the threat of wildfires and its devastating effects on wildlife caught in the path of flame fronts that are both larger and faster traveling than any previously seen in a drought-parched western U.S. Contrary to what many believe, wildlife are particularly vulnerable in fires and often are trapped in conflagrations that can have deadly results. More and more large animals like bears and mountain lions are being severely burned, and in the past, techniques for treating such animals were very limited. Dr. Jamie Payton from UC Davis is pioneering techniques for taking care of severely burned wildlife, and she joins us to talk about it from her farm in Northern California. Jamie Payton, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I'm so grateful to be able to come and talk about what we're doing.
Yeah, and I want to get into depth in what you're doing with the wildlife in burn situations in a bit, but I'd like to know a little bit more about you to start out. Because, you know, when most people go into veterinary medicine, you think about they're taking care of, you know, people's domestic animals. Tell us about the pathway you took to take care of wildlife.
Oh my gosh, it is a wild and twisty path. But, you know, I find ever since I was young, I've loved helping animals, but also helping people and being part of a community and giving back and doing service. It was instilled in me from a pretty young age. And so I went through the kind of regular sort of path, went to veterinary school. And after vet school, I knew I wanted to kind of look into a more specialized area. And keep learning because there's so many opportunities in veterinary medicine. You can take a lot of different paths, which is pretty exciting. And you can change over time too. So I went on to do a internship and residency in small animal emergency and critical care and finished that. And then went on to work in private practice for several years, helping with some renal transplants on animals, taking care of lots of different dogs and cats, and then really started focusing on pain management and wound care and transitioned to doing integrative medicine. So really focusing on combining all the things that I've learned in the past, but adding other things. So thinking outside the box, using things like acupuncture and chiropractic care, and really looking at a whole picture to come up with solutions. And from that, I started working on all different species, so large animals, small animals, and also our wildlife and exotic. And, you know, looking at all the similarities that a lot of these species have and trying to find the best solutions. And then, you know, as life goes along, things, you know, come across your path that really help direct you where you're supposed to be and where you're supposed to help. And for me, you know, living in our area, we started, of course, having much more severe and increased frequency in wildfires. And even where we live, we've currently been evacuated from our farm 8 times.
And wow.
Yeah, and seeing all the effects on my colleagues and my friends and family that have been evacuated or lost their homes, it really became a huge issue to look into burn care for our companion animals and our livestock. And so I started really getting involved in disaster response in those areas. But along those lines, I got a call from California Department of Fish and Wildlife back in 2017 about a burn bear. And that was sort of my first thought about, well, what happens to the wildlife? And working with CDFW at that time, we took care of two adult bears and a mountain lion. And that was the first time that we've ever been able to successfully treat adult wildlife animals with burn injuries and get them back to the wild. And it started me down that path, to really figure out how I could be a part of this effort.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so 2017, was that the Thomas Fire in Southern California?
It was.
So, when people think about wildlife and wildfires, they always just assume, well, the animals are, going to get, they have the natural instincts. They're going to get out of the way and they'll be fine. But that's not the case, especially with these massive, rapidly burning fires. Could you address that a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting change. So in the past, just like you mentioned, it really has been the thought, oh, they'll get out of the way. It is natural. Well, there's different levels to that. Number one, a lot of the fires that we're seeing now are really not started by natural causes. Some are, but things have changed. And with climate change, we're seeing much more severe increase in not only the severity, but also the frequency. And there's these large areas that are getting burned. And, I always tell people animals don't have inherent GPS, so they don't always know where to go and they can get caught in the fire just like people. And with these large areas burning, a lot of them are getting trapped and not being able to get out. And then we forget, even when they try to get out, if they see some of the first responders and people, they're going to turn back around. We had that case where they were actually going back into the fire. So it's just a different time. It's, we're seeing these disasters be different and we have to change our thinking about how we can take responsibility for some of this that's going on and be a part of the solution in helping the wildlife so that they don't suffer.
And part of the model, you have an organization now through UC Davis. It's called the Wildlife Disaster Network, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, that was modeled after a lot of the people who were treating birds and wildlife that were affected by oil spills. Could you talk a little bit about how you modeled your organization after what you saw they were doing?
Sure. It's a really interesting thing because one of my mantras is always making something positive from something negative. And with the wildfires, with the experience we've had working with CDFW, and then myself and my husband went down to Australia last year and worked with the wildlife in the wild and the bushfires down there, and really started thinking we need to do something for the missing component of disaster response, which is for wildlife. And, it just so happens that at UC Davis, the Oil Wildlife Network, Care Network, has been in place and they are very successful and they've mounted excellent responses for oil spills. And we thought, we could model after what they have already established, but really focus on all disasters and especially in California, the wildfires, and then try to build that collaboration as well, both nationally and internationally in the future.
Yeah. And you mentioned Australia, and I remember thinking last winter for us, which was summer for them, the terrible wildfires in Australia. And I just remember thinking to myself, that's going to be us in six months. And it really was.
No, it's a really difficult time. But again, what has been coming out of this is that we have a lot of great collaboration between Australia and ourselves, as well as looking at our colleagues down in the Amazon region, because we're all going through these similar things. And it does bring people together and helps our colleagues and I all work together to try to find solutions. So that's really what we've been trying to focus on.
I'd like you to, because when I'm thinking about this, I'm visualizing how do we come across, like, let's take the example of one of the bears that you've treated, and we'll get to how you treat them in a minute, because that's really fascinating. But what's the initial contact? What does that look like? How do we find an animal like a bear? And somebody's found this animal that's severely wounded and burned. How do we go through the process of all of a sudden from that to now you're going to get that animal into some kind of treatment situation?
Yeah, so basically what it looks like is we often find these animals in evacuated areas. So usually first responders are finding them because as the habitat gets destroyed, they'll seek out water. And sometimes that's usually at people's houses. So either they're being found by first responders or the public. And what we have created is actually a wildlife disaster network. So at that number, people can call and report an animal that they're finding after these wildfires or other disasters and tell us about them, what they're seeing. Usually those animals look like not normal. And what I mean by that is typically wildlife doesn't want to be around people. They're going to usually stay away from you, but these animals are not moving like they should. They're out during the day or in areas that people typically don't see them. In the bears per se, we often find them not being able to walk. So these animals will be crawling across people's driveways or crawling in the woods. And that's probably the most common call that we're seeing for the bears. And then once we receive that call, we get the information. And then we organize a team, typically of the veterinarians through the network, as well as CDFW biologists. And we'll go out and we actually go and track those animals and find them and then safely retrieve them and bring them back into care and assess their injuries and then make a plan for how we're going to get them healed up and back out to the wild.
Okay, well, I'm a kid who grew up watching Marlon Perkins and Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom back in the day. So I'm picturing this. Can you tell us, you say you safely get them. What does that look like? How do you tranquilize them? What do you have to do to get that animal safely to your facility?
Yeah, it depends on the location and the size of the animal. But if we look at bears or the mountain lions, the most important thing is to find them, but you know, we're not going to just go after them. You have to keep them safe and try to stay at a reasonable distance so they don't feel overtly threatened. And then we will usually dart them. So we'll dart them with a tranquilizer so that they fall asleep. And then once they're asleep, and it sounds really easy. You go and you get them when they're asleep, but sometimes the terrain can be really difficult. One of our last calls, we were up one side of a mountain and we had to come down the mountain and bring them up the other side of the mountain. So it's not always that easy, but you know, we love what we do. And so we try to really minimize the stress to those animals and keep them sedate until we can get them where we can dress their wounds and then have a nice quiet area to heal, usually at one of our rehab centers.
Yeah, and a bear, you know, is like 500-pound animal. That can't be easy getting them, you know. Like when I started thinking about that, I have this picture in my head of it's like a nice flat spot and you put them on a thing and put them in the truck. It's like, no, you got to hike them out of there. That must be, that, did you have any stories about, you know, a particularly difficult retrieval?
Yeah.
Terrain-wise.
The 500-pound bears are a little more challenging. They require a lot more people. But, you know, one of the bears that we went to retrieve, he was young. He was a yearling, probably about 75 pounds, but still 75 pounds, you know, is quite a lot when you're hiking up and down. So our team, you know, when I think about how proud I am about our team, because you know, none of us even think twice, wading through, you know, a foot of ash. You know, these are not the easy environments. So we're literally going down a ravine filled with ash, everything's burned, and then trying to climb up the hill. And now you have a bear. So there definitely was a few spills on our part. But, you know, it's all about the animal. And you know, that's really what we focus on, and trying to keep that animal safe and our team safe too. But it definitely is an adventure and totally worthwhile.
Wow, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jamie Payton, a wildlife veterinarian who specializes in treating animals suffering from injuries due to wildfires. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue now as we talk to UC Davis veterinarian Jamie Payton. Payton is pioneering techniques to treat animals burned in wildfires.
When I think about, you know, these animals, and I've, you know, have dogs and things, the pads of their feet are getting burned. And so that must be like, you know, the biggest problem. You said they were crawling. So you have this bear with, you know, severely burned feet. Their pads are burned. And then I saw that you do this remarkable treatment using fish skins, tilapia skin. But I'd like you to explain to us, first of all, how did you come up with the idea of using tilapia skin? And take us through the process of what do you actually do with the skin?
Sure. So we came up with the idea. Again, it's all about being challenged. And when we had the first bear that came along, so in the past, like I said, back up, in the past when we've done veterinary burn care, a lot of our burn care is using topical ointments and bandages. And a lot of that medicine hasn't really progressed in veterinary medicine per se in a long time. And when the bear came along, that first one from the Thomas fire, it was, you know, we knew that with the wildlife, we can't do those bandages. We cannot bandage them because in case they take them off, they'll eat them and get obstructed. And, you know, we can't make wildlife take their pain medication, especially, you know, a 300-pound bear. It's even with donuts, it just doesn't work all the time. And so we thought, well, we need something else to manage her pain. And I really needed something to cover those wounds and help them heal fast because you're limited in the amount of time that those animals can stay in care. And so I thought, well, what else is out there? And that's really where you start the journey, looking into what else is out there and what can I make or modify to make this work. And I started really investigating what was going on in the human medicine world for burn care, which is a lot of research and has really been progressing, and found that one of the best ways to treat wounds when you can't do true skin grafts is using another type of skin as sort of a biological bandage. And I thought, aha, this is what we need. And then it became, well, what type of biological bandage? The ones that are on the market for people are typically made from porcine or bovine, but they're really expensive. And that's one of the limitations when you have a huge bear paw that is only being paid for by donor money, you know, it really becomes an issue. And so we had to say, well, that's not going to work. And so I thought, well, what other source could I look into that would have a tough enough skin that would be a byproduct and be less expensive? And so, you know, I thought about, well, what about fish? Because about 40% of the fish industry, when they process fish, is waste. And I thought, this is perfect. We could look into using fish skin. And then I had talked to some of the group down in Brazil. They were looking at tilapia specifically for people. And I thought, I wonder if we could do that for animals. And that's what really started it. And it was trial and error in our lab and then trying it out. And it worked really well. And, you know, that bear went from not walking to walking on her feet. And it was really exciting to see.
Wow. And what is there something specific about tilapia that it works well, or is it just that it's available it's readily available and not too expensive? Is there something special about tilapia? I was just thinking, why not some other type of fish skin?
Yeah, and right now actually we're looking at other types as well, but tilapia has had some of the most extensive research just because it is the most highly farmed fish in the world. And we do know that it has a lot of collagen, so it's very collagen rich, very similar to how human skin is made up. And so that collagen has been shown to help with wound healing. So that was one component. The other component is tilapia is a really tough fish. You know, you think if you're that highly farmed, you have a little bit more resistance and you can, you know, hold up. And so we thought, And now we're looking at even other components of the tilapia that may make it more special and explain some of the effects that we're seeing.
Huh, that's interesting. And can you explain to us what exactly do you do? Are you like sewing the skin onto the bear's pads? What, tell us about like the actual procedure you do.
Yeah, so the tilapia really works like a biological bandage, and it can be put on in multiple different ways. The key is it has to be close in contact with the wound to get some of the benefits. So in the bears, for example, because we don't want to use any other bandages, we have to attach it. So usually we suture it onto their feet, but sometimes we glue it. You can do tissue glue. And then other areas of the body for different animals, we have also used surgical staples, which are, you know, really helpful to be able to do. And then in a lot of the companion animals that can have bandages, we just use it as a dressing. You don't really attach it. You just place it on there and then bandage them up. So it's really versatile, which is nice. It is just like any other, you know, you would think of as a true Band-Aid, like a bandage.
And can you explain to us, like, are there other types of injuries that you treat, you know, related to fires besides just, you know, burn pads? What are some other, you know, things that you wind up having to do to help animals that have been through a fire situation? I'm thinking of like, do they have smoke inhalation, problems breathing, that kind of thing?
Oh, you are exactly right. So fires by nature, you know, have a lot of, when people are affected and animals are affected, the first thing we think about is wounds because of the burn wounds, but there are a lot of other things that happen to you when you have burn injuries. So we've treated quite a few animals with smoke inhalation. All the bears that we've treated had some degree of smoke inhalation, and that can be range from mild to really clinical and severe, you know, because there's toxins with that as well. We have animals that develop heart disease secondary to that smoke inhalation. Some that have been out, you know, unfortunately out in the wild with injuries, they can't find water, they can't find food. So we see them coming in severely dehydrated with damage to their kidneys. And we see them emaciated from starvation. So, you know, when you have those injuries, we also deal with infections, both infections in the wound and infections throughout the body that can be deadly. So there's many factors, and that's one of the things I personally love about, you know, dealing with burn injured animals is it's not just the wounds, it's what becomes a big factor, but it's every component. It's looking at the animal as a whole.
Yeah. And then typically, you know, with the case of some of the bears that you've treated, like, for example, there was a pretty good sized bear that was in the Zog fire, which is not far from where I live, up around Cottonwood, Anderson, that area. Is that animal still in treatment, or do you know about that animal?
Yeah, so that we actually had two bears from that area. One is the big bear. So he is doing really well. He actually, I'm pretty sure that, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you yet, but they're actually looking at releasing him pretty darn soon. So that is a huge success. He's doing very well. And then the other little bear from that area is still in care, but her wounds are all healed. She's back to being a happy, healthy bear cub, but she'll stay in a rehabilitation center with other little orphan bears until spring, just because they need to hibernate over the winter. So both bears are doing great.
Oh, good. And so how long does it usually last? Because that was what, a month or a month and a half ago. So from the time that you get these animals, you're able to get them out back out in the wild within, you know, a month or two?
Well, it's really amazing. I have to say, I'm still in awe kind of where we're at in a time frame, because typically the wounds that we've seen in the past, when we see full thickness burns, you know, it can take months and months of time to heal. And what we're seeing now with most of the animals we're taking into care, depending on the degree of wounds, like if they've burned all their skin off or just part of their skin, I know that sounds brutal, but it makes a big difference in your ability to heal. They can heal either within 3 weeks, and we've released in 3 weeks is probably the earliest, where other ones are usually more like 6 to 8 weeks. But still, that's a pretty quick turnaround.
That's pretty fast.
Considering, yeah, and I think that's because we have been working so hard as a team to make sure we do all the most advanced treatments and really think of whole body care so that we can get them back out into the wild, because that's where, you know, that's why we do what we do.
Think, tell me about the structure of your team. What does it look like structurally as far as, you know, the organization of the team and the kind of people that you have in it?
Yeah, so this year is our first year really kind of creating our network. So right now it's made up of four veterinarians from UC Davis, and two are also partnered. They're actually with the OWCN, the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. And then we're also have the veterinarians with CDFW. So we have quite a few veterinarians on staff, and then working with all the CDFW biologists. So that's really sort of the core of the initial, you know, hotline, as well as going out and do reconnaissance and initial care. But the most important part is, you know, treating their wounds initially is only one component. It really is long-term, right? Those weeks of care. So that's where we have our wildlife rehab centers that are also part of our team. And then we also have the first responders and the public that we need to be able to find these animals and then get them into care as well.
How many of these rehabilitation centers are there in, like, for example, in California?
There's, you know, there's quite a few. It just depends on the area. I don't, unfortunately, have the exact number. Now, we have been working in our area as we, you know, are still a small group, but we're building it. In Northern California, we've been working with our Gold Country Wildlife Rescue, which is in Auburn. And then we've worked with Napa Wildlife and our Lake Tahoe Wildlife. And then we have a couple groups down in Southern California, like Project Wildlife Ramona. And then, you know, trying to figure out more groups to join our team. And that's something that I think is exciting for the future, is even though this year was sort of the beginning, there's a lot of potential for us to grow and bring in other groups and other people. And so I think it has a lot of potential to move forward.
And of course, you're affiliated with the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. Is there a prominent role that students are playing in this whole process?
Not yet, because we're so new, but that is the goal. You know, students are such a valuable resource, and I do think it's important for them to not only learn the medicine, but to focus on service too, and being service to our community. That's a big issue for me, is making sure that we instill that in our students.
You know, I know wildlife rescue has been going on for a very long time, but as far as like the information that you're gathering from these fires, what was like the baseline state of knowledge, the database, if you will, scientifically, when you first started working on this compared to now? And like, explain to us how important it is to gather data from these burned animals.
Yeah, it's been such a learning. I'm still taken back with how many things we are learning every day with these fires. In the past, we really haven't had much information. There's been some studies that looked at animal and population recoveries, you know, months down the road. But there really hasn't been much looked at as far as what animals are surviving, which animals are dying, which animals are being injured and need help. And so part of the network's mission is not only to, you know, rescue, rehabilitate, and then release, it's also to gather that data and to learn from it and use that data to try to help us figure out what is happening to our environment and happening to the species that are affected and how we can then move forward with solutions.
Yeah, because when I think about these gigantic fires, like the ones we've had this year, were the largest in California history, for example, over there with the Mendocino complex fire over there that was caused by all the lightning in basically a wilderness area. And so a lot of wildlife there from, you know, from little tiny creatures, you know, that are invertebrates, you know, to birds, to, you know, the larger fauna like the bears and mountain lions and deer and things like that. Are you able to gather any information, or are we able to gather information on what the mortality rate is for wildlife in these fires? How much damage is being done to the biosphere, to all of these wild creatures in these burned areas? Are we gathering data about the big picture of that?
We are, and that's something we're working on right now. We don't have all the data compiled yet, but we are compiling that data. And what we're finding is it definitely depends on location, what type of brush and foliage are in those fires, and also how fast that fire is moving, because that really affects an animal's ability to get out of the way. And then what we're doing is looking at, you know, are the birds affected? What birds? Are we seeing more of injuries to our predators? And a lot of the animals we have in care are predator species, which makes sense because, you know, if they're unable to get out of the way, they will get injured, but then they have nothing to eat, because that's a huge thing. If all the prey is killed, there's nothing to eat. And then the impact of that. And then also the component of, well, what happens when they're trying to recover, and what does that look like? And we don't have that information compiled yet, but it's really interesting to figure out what it will look like and what we can use that data for in the future.
So I know that the Wildlife Disaster Network is also, you know, you depend on donations, and people can do that if because I when I watch some of the procedures you were doing with the bear, I was just found that inspiring, and I made a small donation, and I would encourage, you know, listeners to this program, if you find this, you know, inspiring too, to do that. So how do people go about supporting the Wildlife Disaster Network?
Well, one, thank you so much for your donation and for bringing this up, because everything we're doing right now is all supported by donor funds. This is a newer organization, so we're trying to get a foothold. So everyone's individual contribution is really going directly towards getting supplies and the care of these animals. So, and we're always super grateful for that support. Right now we have a link available. So we actually have a link to a fund, which is our Wildlife Disaster Network Fund through UC Davis, that you can go to and support and give that way. The other way is to actually call UC Davis Office of Advancement and tell them that you would like to donate to the Wildlife Disaster Network Fund.
Well, Jamie Payton, it's been a joy to talk to you, and thanks for sharing this fascinating work you're doing. And I'll never eat tilapia again without thinking about you and treating those bears.
Well, thanks.
Thanks to our guest, Jamie Payton, from the University of California at Davis. After a short break, we'll talk to another veterinary science expert from UC Davis, Marcella Uhart, who will tell us about her work combating the global problem of wildlife trafficking. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's now turn our attention from wildlife imperiled from wildfires to the global problem of wildlife trafficking. Our guest is Marcella Uhart. She's a UC Davis wildlife veterinary scientist who is one of the world's foremost experts on wildlife trafficking and its potential role in spreading pandemics. Uhart is based in Argentina, where she directs the Latin America program of the Karen C. Draper Wildlife Health Center, a part of the UC Davis One Health Institute. She recently was an important contributor in a report on the issue of wildlife trafficking for the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. Dr. Marcella Uhart, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. My pleasure to be here with you today.
First of all, I'd like to step back a little bit. Tell us about how you first got interested in this kind of work.
Well, I've been working in, I'm a wildlife veterinarian, so I've been working in wildlife conservation field and science for conservation for many, many years now. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious quickly anywhere around the world and in my area in Latin America, you know, how significant the impact of the wildlife trade can be for the conservation of many species. So, I think over time we've seen these links more and more obvious just because the pressure on their environments and on species particularly has increased so dramatically.
And what are some of the like the typical species that are trafficked, that are part of the wildlife trafficking network?
Yeah, so that actually varies around the world. So in some places, wildlife are targeted for, say, traditional medicines. And in that case, you know, the typical ones are, you know, the rhino horn and, you know, pangolin scales now and the bear bile, which is leads to so many issues. And then in other places, wildlife trade is all about pets and exotic pets. And that is, for example, huge in the US and Europe. The previous one is huge in Asia. And then in other places, it's mostly a supply source for these markets. And then finally, I was almost forgetting the other big one that actually relates to mostly to farming of animals, but many of those are wild sourced, is the fur industry, for example. And then, of course, you know, many people eat the meat of wildlife as well.
Yeah, and but they want exotic meat. They don't want just, you know, the wildlife that is around them that they might, you know, lawfully hunt. These are people that want to eat exotic wildlife.
Yeah, so there's the, you know, there's of course the subsistence hunting that occurs, you know, for many indigenous communities around the world, of course. But yeah, beyond that, then there's all this exotic cuisine around some of these species. And then in other cases, it's also traditional and cultural. In Asia, for example, there's lots of consumption of, you know, field rats, and, you know, these huge rodents are commonly, you know, sourced for food. I think there was this study in Vietnam that where it said that the consumption of these rodents is about, you know, 3,000 tons of meat a year. That's a lot of. So, yeah, there's a huge demand, actually a lot more than we would normally think of. Actually, it's pretty daunting. And the numbers of animals that are required to fulfill those needs are quite significant.
Yeah. And you mentioned bear bile a moment ago, but for those of us who don't really understand what that's all about, could you explain that to us?
Yeah, definitely not an expert on that. There seem to be some idea that the bile of bears have some special medicinal properties, and there's a huge trade around that, but that for the most part involves keeping these bears in farms and actually extracting the bile from them while they're alive. So, you know, it's a pretty significant issue, particularly in terms of welfare and of course the health of these animals. And, you know, it's a very, very issue. It's a huge issue in some parts in Asia specifically. I'm not personally involved in that. I don't know the details, but it is something that is of high concern.
Yeah. So for you personally, what are some of the species that you're most directly involved in?
A lot of my specific work has been mostly in South America, and the trade here is humongous in many areas, but definitely some of the most common traded ones are, you know, ornamental fishes and lots of amphibians and reptiles. But the ones that are of bigger concern, especially in terms of disease and the impacts they have on the environment as well, because usually they're larger mass animals, you know, it's birds and some mammals. And there's been this interesting, worrying change recently where as some of the most common animals traded, like tigers and bears and the pangolins are being replaced by other species. So now we're seeing, for example, that jaguars in South America or giant anteaters or Andean spectacle bears are being targeted for these Asian markets. So as we deplete the populations in other parts of the world of relative species, not these same ones, then we're seeing huge impacts here where we're seeing, you know, 200-fold increases in the number of jaguars, for example, killed and traded now recently in the last 10 years, I would say.
And is this mostly in Central America where the jaguars are being hunted and traded? Where is this? Where is this mostly happening?
Central and South America. And, you know, I don't have to say, well, maybe I do have to say this, but jaguars are, you know, large animals that have require huge territories and habitat. So they're top predators. So, you know, they are already not doing very well because we're putting a lot of pressure on them. So actually the loss of any individual pretty much is devastating in many places. And then, you know, some of the most common food items and actually species that are for indigenous peoples like peccaries that are also essential for keeping forests alive because they act as seed dispersers. They disperse the seeds of plants and they actually break them down to a point that they can actually grow and make a new plant. You know, peccaries are being exterminated from some areas of Central America now. So it's pretty worrying.
And for our listeners, you may know peccaries are kind of a wild type of pig, right?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I could see how they would be important for seed dispersal.
Exactly. And they live in big groups. So they really are like architectures of a forest in many places. And many communities actually rely on them very heavily and our forests, of course.
Yeah. And what kind of things are you involved in and are we doing to combat this wildlife trade?
I would say first and foremost, not enough. In this recent report that I was involved in, we looked at the increase in the wildlife trade. And over the last 20, 30 years, the wildlife trade has increased about 500-fold. And if we look at a further timeline, it's increased 2,000-fold. And this is only a few decades back. And this is worth millions of dollars, many millions of dollars. I think it's a highly profitable trade and therefore very challenging to combat. And it is increasingly linked to criminal activity, sadly, and then in some cases becoming more and more complicated to detect and prevent and stop because a lot of the selling of animals and pieces is now happening online. So that goes basically unchecked. So we have systems in place, for example, in airports to screen, you know, how they screen your luggage when you arrive in a country. Mm-hmm. And actually a lot is picked up. You would be amazed by the numbers that are detected in the US, for example. And so, you know, some of those methods of screening are no longer an alternative when, you know, things are being sold online and it's kind of like going through the mail unchecked because, you know, nobody would expect to find a pangolin scale in an envelope or a package or something.
Yeah.
So a lot of the, you know, what we're thinking increasingly, aside from, you know, treating this as a criminal activity, which it is, and in most cases where we're talking about unregulated or unsustainable or illegal trade, right? Because there's some species that are actually legal to be traded and there's a legal system for that. But the one that is illegal for the most part, so you tackle it the same way you do with other things like, you know, illegal drug trade. But I think that the most significant way to get to the source of this is working on demand, which is the consumers, which is people. And we just have to be a lot better at educating the public about how impactful this is, how unsustainable it is, how this traffic is affecting one of every five vertebrate species that exist. 25% of all species known of the vertebrates are affected by the wildlife trade and are actually significantly decreasing in numbers because of this. So for most of the species that are threatened in some way, so 75% of those are actually threatened because of some sort of trade. So we really have to, you know, think individually ourselves and work a lot on transforming the public and making every person aware of what this means and how, you know, we do not need exotic pets. We can, you know, we should be able to live with dogs and cats that were domesticated by humans to be by us and with us and actually communicate a lot better. And all these other species pose great risks to our health, to our environment, to our sustainability.
Can you address that a bit? Because, you know, that is also one of the big components here, is this is a way of spreading disease around the world, isn't it?
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, when you think of, you know, the reasons or the drivers behind some of the most recent scary and impactful emerging diseases and even pandemics, you know, the wildlife trade is right there. It's at the source. So we're still a little bit unsure about COVID-19, but we definitely know there was a wildlife trade component in SARS. There's definitely a wildlife component in MERS, which is another coronavirus respiratory disease. And before that, the well-known ones of Ebola, that is linked to wildlife consumption, and HIV/AIDS, the biggest pandemic ever, you know, affecting 32 million people, killing actually that many people over since its emergence. It's linked exactly to the wildlife trade and wildlife consumption. So this is really highly significant. Actually, in the U.S. also, you had a very significant outbreak of monkeypox several years ago from the import of some big rodents from Africa for the pet trade that were placed in pet stores, and there they commingled with prairie dogs. And then those prairie dogs became infected with this monkeypox that is an exotic disease for the U.S. And the prairie dogs were then purchased by families and infected several people, fortunately with no deaths, but many people got sick. And since then, actually, that trade for all rodents coming from Africa has been stopped by the CDC in the U.S.
So and we're about out of time, but sounds to me like the bottom line here is the best way to attack this is at the demand, from the demand vector, if you will. What's the best way to go about convincing people that these animals need to belong where they are and not be in brought to other countries, and certainly not in your homes. That's what dogs and cats are for goodness sake.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we definitely do not need exotic pets. We do not need exotic protein from wild animals to supplement our food. Actually, have issues with overfeeding ourselves and developed nations. And we definitely, you know, even though we rely heavily on nature for developing therapeutics, drugs, and treatments, you know, there are options to traditional medicines as well. So I would alert us, because the scale at which this is happening is definitely not sustainable. I mean, we are losing species at a rate that is completely unprecedented. You know, before too long, and within the next few years, we will have lost a million species only since the turn of the century.
Wow. Yeah, well, it's just a staggering problem. And thank you for sharing this with us, even though it's a difficult thing to hear about, but it's important. I appreciate your expertise and spending the time with us.
Thank you very much for the invite, and my pleasure.
Thanks again to our guests, Dr. Jamie Payton and Marcella Uhart from the University of California at Davis. You can help the wildlife that are treated by the Wildlife Disaster Network by making a contribution to their work through the UC Davis website, and we'll provide a link in the show description on our website. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.